It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's the day after the day after the longest day of the year. The daylight will start declining now. That's going to be an important thing for a lot of creatures, including you. But what's not going to decline is the heat. Daytime temperatures maybe not a lot hotter in general, but nighttime temperatures are going to stay very warm. Steve said he got in the car. It was 80 degrees already this morning on his way to work. And that means a lot of things. I have to remind you that it is, it means your tomatoes are not going to be happy. And we're going to talk a little bit about tomatoes today. We're going to talk a lot about tomatoes, not because it's time for tomatoes along the Gulf Coast, but because it's time to put them to bed. It's time to realize that you're probably not going to get a lot more tomatoes after this next week. It's going to be tough. We'll talk about why. We're going to talk about what does happen now along the Gulf Coast. It's interesting that as we're saying goodbye to the Gulf, to tomatoes on the Gulf Coast, we're saying hello to tomatoes in North Alabama. Some of you have already been picking ripe tomatoes, I hope, I expect, in Montgomery and Birmingham. Maybe even in Huntsville. And you'll have a while to enjoy them. But increasingly, your tomato growing conditions are going to look more and more like tomato growing conditions in Mobile. And so you're going to have to think about those things because we are getting more hot days in summer. And we are getting hotter nights. And that's the most important thing when it comes to growing tomatoes. There's another trick that I've been thinking about with tomatoes, and I just in my year in tomato review that I'm keeping very much in mind, and that is that it's going to be harder and harder to find a good tomato at the grocery store, at wherever you buy your tomatoes. And maybe you've gotten sort of halfway used to eating sort of halfway decent tomatoes at the grocery store that come in many colors and that are so-called heirloom tomatoes. And some of them may actually have a little better flavor than some of the tomatoes you get at Subway, for example, or some other place that are at the hamburger joints or wherever that serve really sorry tomatoes with their hamburgers. Those kind of really bad salad tomatoes that you end up with and you almost want to pick them out and put them on the side. You may be able to find better tomatoes now, but you're not going to be able to find those as easily in the future, and there's many reasons for that. One, you got to have folks to pick them. Two, you got to have relationships with countries where those tomatoes are grown and grown well, better than we grow them in Florida, arguably better than we grow them in Alabama at commercial facilities. I'm going to say that out loud and just let it ride. And that has a lot to do with not our soils or not even our climate, but with the kind of tomatoes we grow and the kind of markets we choose to court. So we'll talk about all of that. We got a lot of things coming, but what are you going to do about tomatoes? Let me talk about tomatoes for a second. Then we're going to talk about basil, which is a lot of fun. Increasingly we're going to see, and I'm worried about this. We're going to see more of these hydroponic tomatoes. I I don't guess I understand the economics of it very well. I do understand something about how you grow tomatoes and what tomato flavor is, and there's some great new studies that back that up. Well, they're not so new, but they're recently done, and they tell you when you start looking at these studies a lot about why tomatoes taste good and why they may not. And one of the things that happens when you grow a tomato is varieties make a lot of difference. There's no question. Within varieties, there's a lot of difference in how much sugar they have, how much acid they have, citric acid, which gives them that sprightly, bright quality, and how many other different flavor qualities, everything from peppermint-like flavors to vegetable flavors, green flavors. There's a whole series of other flavor profiles in a tomato that can depend on varieties. But there's some other things that interact with varieties that sometimes almost override variety differences. And that's how those tomatoes are grown. And so they did some great studies looking at numerous different varieties that actually they knew had different sugar contents and other things, and comparing them to, say, hydroponic cultivation and soil cultivation to see what would happen. Hydroponics means that there's no soil involved. It's basically like a laboratory where the tomatoes are grown in circulating water, and they're given precise amounts of nutrients, and they're probably mostly pest-free. Probably they're more disease-free, those tomatoes are. And they compared them to what was grown in the soil, and there was a huge difference. One of the differences, very measurable, was that regardless of variety, the tomatoes that were grown in real soil had more sugars. The ones grown hydroponically had far fewer sugars. Isn't that interesting? But there were also differences in phenol content and some other things. And this was the really interesting thing to me about these things, is that the bacterial content of the tomatoes changed dramatically from hydroponically grown tomatoes to field grown tomatoes. Now this is going to tease you a little bit, because you're not thinking about bacteria giving tomatoes flavor, but they in fact do. They're a big part of the flavor profile, as it turns out, and probably the aroma profile and other things. And what happened was, is that both the hydroponic and the field grown tomatoes, they both had bacteria that were associated with flavors that were circulating in the tomato. But the tomatoes that were grown in the hydroponic situation had very low bacterial diversity. And the ones that were grown in the soil profile had a lot of diversity in bacteria. And as a result, its flavor profile was very different. And it included some of those subtle elements, like some of the peppermint-like flavors, that just enough to give a little bit of bite to that tomato and increase its sense of depth and complexity. The things that we really appreciate in tomatoes. It was coming from the soil, and it wasn't just the nutrients in the soil, it was the microorganisms in the soil that were contributing to that we've managed to filter out when we did hydroponic growing. Isn't that interesting? And that probably explains my reaction to hydroponic tomatoes, which most of the time I think I can tell, just because there's a certain flatness. We're going to be back. We're going to talk about more about tomatoes. We're going to talk about how to grow them. We're going to talk about how to think about them, even as we're saying goodbye to them right now. We'll be back. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas.
Because everything's on the phone. You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the deep south with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning, thinking about tomatoes. Thinking about the reasons why it helps to grow tomatoes in gardens. And so we talked a little bit about, well, we talked a lot about, it's going to be harder and harder to find good tomatoes. We're setting up, it's been hard for a while, but we were actually getting to the point where you could go to the grocery store and you could get decent tomatoes from, generally from Mexico, or tomatoes picked, well, I'll let you figure out who was picking those tomatoes in the U.S., and what's going to happen is they're going to be harder to find, and that means it's going to be more on you to grow those tomatoes. We're going to see more, I suspect we'll see more of a push to get hydroponically grown tomatoes. And there's reasons for that. They can be, in theory, they can be closer to markets. In theory, they can be picked closer to ripeness. Don't know that they are. I think they, you know, I don't know. I think in theory there's some sensible things about hydroponically grown tomatoes, but one of the things about hydroponically grown tomatoes that it's fairly easy to say is that they ain't going to taste like tomatoes grown in dirt. And the reason we know this, and the reason you need to be thinking about this, and the reason why, for example, growing tomatoes even in containers may not be, they may not produce, be quite as flavorful as tomatoes grown in real dirt, is that a lot of things contribute to tomato flavor. Tomatoes grown in the ground, in the research I'm looking at, regardless of variety, were always sweeter than tomatoes grown hydroponically. And it's quite interesting. But there were other things that the soil was contributing, and other flavors that the soil was contributing. And in wine, I guess we would call that terroir. The local quality of the soils, and we think, oh, well, it's about the chemistry of the soil, it's about... No, as it turns out, it's about living things in the soil, things like bacteria and other things. It may also be about growing in soil, and this is something really important to think about, is probably for the tomato plant a little more stressful, just a little more stressful than growing in ideal conditions in a greenhouse, in a spaceship, in those kinds of areas. And what that does is it helps to produce sugars. Just like when you say your collards are always better, your cabbage is always better when it's touched by frost because it develops sugars as a result of stress, and those sugars help to do a lot of things. It also develops phenols and other things that can be really good. If there's too much stress, they might overproduce phenols and other things that can be a problem. So just the fact of stress alone, but beyond that, the bacteria themselves. So I'm going to tell you that in general, you're going to end up with a better tomato grown in the ground, a more complex flavor, a more developed flavor, and that explains why sometimes we're often disappointed by greenhouse grown tomatoes, hydroponically grown tomatoes, which is another step beyond just the greenhouse. Because they're not grown in any soil at all. They're completely buffered from any disease and very, very different conditions. But it also means something else, and this is really important to think about. It means that because there is an interaction between a variety of tomato, the variety of tomato you choose, Cherokee Purple or Amish paste or whatever, something from somewhere else that's some heirloom that's really beautiful somewhere else and people are bragging about it in Minnesota and New England, it may not taste the same when you put it in your soils. And in fact, it often doesn't. And so that complexity of flavor that may be associated with one place and one set of growing conditions, temperature and moisture and even the bacteria in the soil, may not be associated with another place. And so when you talk about heirloom tomatoes, and when we're choosing tomatoes for Mobile or for Montgomery or for Birmingham or Huntsville or Agricola, right, Keith? We got to think about what tomatoes are going to taste like in our soils. How are they going to taste in our conditions? So if I ever seem disgusted with the whole heirloom fascination, that's why. Because heirlooms are about particular places. They're about tomatoes that had a real good history of growing and producing good fruit in a particular place. And it may not and often doesn't translate very well to another place. Things to think about as we're growing tomatoes. You know, I will also tell you that I think we, while we're on the subject of tomatoes, because I'm still very happy with the tomatoes I'm growing, which I've talked to you about before. I'm not going to make a big deal out of them now because I want you all to experiment, and you should. I do think we need to choose tomatoes that can adapt to the changing conditions of where we are. And it's interesting because we didn't have, we didn't have the May and June, and we haven't for a while. We haven't had the dependable May and June cool night, dry day conditions that really produce exceptional tomato harvest. It's almost like July got started earlier. And July on the Gulf Coast, which is coming up, represents the middle of something we call Gulf summer, when we're going to get rain virtually every day. And if we don't get rain, the humidity is going to be very, very high. And that means night temperatures are going to be exceedingly high. And tomatoes don't do well in those high night temperatures, particularly the ones that have been popularly grown throughout the rest of the country. So we're going to need to find tomatoes. And that means we probably need to go back to the heart of tomatoes, and not just Mexico, where tomatoes were developed, but to the places where tomatoes grew wild, and to places in Central and South America where they've adapted tomatoes for high humidity conditions, or maybe even China, where they've done a better job of selecting for highly humid conditions. Not to Italy, where humidity is low and where night temperatures are generally pretty cool all the time. So just thinking about that. And meanwhile, basil's coming on, and that's really exciting. And I've been thinking a lot about it. We've had several meals with basil, but now it's getting to be like I have to stop myself from thinking, oh, I can eat basil for supper tonight in one form or another. Would it be bad if I did that every night? Probably not. Probably be a great thing. Thin my blood, improve my cholesterol, all those wonderful things that I don't think about while I'm eating basil, because basil just makes me happy, and there may actually be a reason that basil makes me happy, and it may have to do with eugenol and other things. We'll be back. Give us a call.
I'm living in the garden again, and I'll keep on praying with two dirty hands. I'm living, yes, living in the garden.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So, David, Michael, my friend who calls in quite a bit or texts in quite a bit, he's a food inspector, and he's telling me about tomatoes grown in Alabama. And there's a lot of factors. So they are under irrigation systems, and they have to be grown under the irrigation has to be put under plastic. And there's many reasons for that plastic, but one of the reasons is it's a food safety requirement. Apparently now, and it's funny how they write those things. Funny how those things get to be done. And it's probably got something to do with how the irrigation water works, and that's too bad. It probably has to do, I don't know. Oh, isn't it complicated? Isn't life complicated? Yeah, so we should talk about that sometime, David. I don't know what the food requirements are for growing tomatoes in the field. The USDA requirements in terms of sterile facilities and issues like that. It seems odd that the irrigation water would be targeted that way. But there you go. I'll try to figure that out. So what else we got? So BDARC, a couple of things. BDARC's tomatoes are doing very well, and she's gotten her cutting started. That's what you should be doing. If you're in Mobile, this is the time of year to do it. Get those cuttings started, so that you can healthy part of your plant, look for a healthy part of your plant. You can also start from seed now. Nothing wrong with starting from seed. Do it now. Get those seeds started. Get those seedlings going. And you can have tomatoes this fall. There are a few problems with growing tomatoes in fall, but there's a lot of advantages. There's always a problem with growing tomatoes. There's issues. There's diseases. But you can... And fall has some of its own challenges, but in many ways, fall may become one of our better seasons for growing tomatoes. And that means instead of just starting them super early, which I recommend, starting your tomatoes even in January, early January, it might be just as well to start them now. They're going to come up faster. They're going to get ready. They'll be producing in late September, October, November, and even into December, and you'll probably get a longer harvest that way. Are there more bugs? Yes, you got to think about that. I don't know whether you'll have more or less stink bugs than you have now in spring. I can't tell you. That's one of the big problems on crops, on tomato crops right now. I don't think you'll have as many tomato hornworms. You may have yeah, they seem to be a bigger problem in midsummer. But it's a great time. I think you'll have less disease, and that's one of the big advantages. All right. What else is going on here? B-Dark finally got her squash seed, which I'm recommending. Kinkai. So B-Dark, pronounce that for me, please, because I don't have a clue. So I'm waiting for you to tell me how to pronounce it. K-I-N-G-K-A-A-E. And generally, A-E, I don't know. Kinkai, I don't know. Pronounce it. A-E in Latin is often I. And I'm probably wrong because Koreans don't speak Latin. So I don't know how you pronounce it. But it's a great little squash, Korean squash. Kingka, K-I-N-G, one word. K-A, another word. A-E. Kinkai, I don't know. But it's a great squash. And it's actually not... The cool thing about those squash is they're not actually native to Korea. They're actually descendants of plants that are native to the Americas and very closely related to plants that have been grown here by people along the Gulf Coast for many thousands of years. It's just that we lost our tradition for growing squash. We borrowed our squash growing traditions from Europe, from zucchini land, which was also once a Native American squash. And we lost our tradition of these winter squash that can be grown as summer squash. But the Koreans discovered it and really done a great job of developing some great cultivars. Great cultivars. So Jim in Georgetown, so it's good. And I'm gonna look at this picture one more time. I'm going to make sure. Yes, indeed. I am now absolutely sure, Jim. Jim sent me a picture. He had an apple tree. The apple tree was a big box store apple tree, which is always a dangerous thing because they're probably going to be very poorly adapted to here. And if they're not poorly adapted, you're going to wish they would die because they're not going to be very flavorful. If they do survive, we can talk about apples. We can talk about how to deal with that on the Gulf Coast. But he got rid of it. Just that's where we need to be. We need to be talking about the fact that he got rid of this tree because it was no good. Lesson to all. That's the first lesson. The second lesson was a tree grew up in its place. And Jim said, oh, well, was this a rootstock that was used for that apple tree, which is a logical question. I mean, it's a reasonable hypothesis that it was the rootstock. And he asked me, I heard they were using pear on apples. I haven't actually heard of that. I'm not saying it's not done, but I don't. Generally, that's not the way it's done for a lot of reasons. So, no, it would be an apple. It would be a Malus rootstock. It would be an apple family rootstock, probably M111 or something from Russia, actually, from some Russian plants that were developed at places like Cornell and other places. Any rate, it would be an apple rootstock, but I will tell you, the tree that Jim had growing from his hole, which seemed, the hypothesis was good that it was the rootstock and it looked interesting, is not in fact an apple at all. Not even close. It's a black cherry. And black cherry, let's talk about black cherry. It's a native tree. It's absolutely widespread, grows in field rows a lot, grows along roadsides. We don't have field rows anymore, excuse me. We've gotten rid of them all. But it does grow along roadsides, grows in areas where the mowers can't get, along fences. And why does it grow there? It grows there because birds love the fruit. And they are spreading it everywhere they perch. So you're going to see it. You're going to see it a lot, and likely a bird perched in what was left of that miserable tree that Jim in Georgetown took out and deposited that seed a while back, and it, there it is, boom. And Jim let it grow. Is it worth growing? Well, a couple of things about black cherry. Makes beautiful wood, right? And even on the Gulf Coast, it can make beautiful wood, because I've got a sideboard that was built by my good friend George, great boat builder down there near the bayou. And it just beautiful out of a cherry that was blown down during a hurricane. Makes great wood. It is prone to fungal attacks. A lot of the cherries are. For some reason, those fungal attacks seem less common along the Gulf Coast, but the trees don't get to be really large sizes. But it still makes a very beautiful wood. So, yes, in that sense, it's very good. To get a big timber tree, it's going to take a while, and it's going to take up a lot of space, and it's going to cast a lot of shade, and you're going to have to think about that. Will it happen in your lifetime? Possibly. And I no slight on our lifetimes, Jim, but, I mean, it takes a while to produce timber. Are the fruits good? Actually, the fruits are quite delicious. You can do a lot of things with them, just like the birds do. They're very small. They're very pungent. They're very strong flavored. But a lot of when we use the word black cherry, we often when you see it in grocery store black cherry, it often refers to a traditional cherry that is black, that has somewhat of the flavor of the native black cherry, but is milder. But this is really sort of the black cherry extract. It's really the best of the black cherries, has really great flavor. Can you use those? Yes. And Jim, I would think you want to experiment with them. Again, it takes a while for those things to grow up. And then two, you got to figure out, gosh, how am I going to reach all them berries? So one thing I would start doing, Jim, and this is a great experiment since you're determined to keep that tree, is don't make a timber tree out of it. Make a fruit tree out of it. Take the top out of it. Cut the top. We can talk about it later so that it doesn't have a strong central leader. You're going to do a modified central leader. You're going to get it to branch out so that those branches stay low so that it'll be easier for you to pick the fruit. And then you're going to try that for a couple of years, and it should start fruiting, I would say, pretty quickly. They're pretty precocious. And you'll determine whether, gosh, this is worth it or it isn't worth it. And then you can cut it down if you like. But, yeah, I think it's worth playing with for you, Jim. It's kind of an interesting thing. Black cherry, as David Hubble points out, makes a great cherry bounce. And David's black cherry bounce was made with the real thing. Black cherries. Did you pick them, David? I can't remember. But he made a great black cherry bounce. So how did we get here? Because Jim asked a question about an apple tree that wasn't an apple tree, and that's where we are. So, Jim, is this all making sense? Yeah. All right.
It's all empty and I don't care. So let me be down there.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Let's see here. What do we got? So David Hubble did pick those from. So take the center out. Yes. So I'm coming, Jim. David Hubble did pick these trees for at his mother's house, which was not specifically grown to make it easy to pick. And David picked quite a bit, I think. So we'll have to get David to report on picking black cherry and whether it's worth it. But David's cherry bounce suggests that it may be. Jim, there's lots of other things. You know, you do all that kind of stuff, Jim, in Georgetown. Jim knows what he does. And obviously, David is suggesting that it makes a good liqueur of various origins, various methods. But it could also make a very good cobbler or a very good sauce or a very good jelly. I think all those things are good. They are seedy, and so you've got to deal with that. So there's a high percentage of seeds in those fruits. That's why you got that little tree. So you've got to strain that out, and you end up with the juice. Is it a problem to eat those seeds? Probably not. Could you just crush the whole thing up? I don't know. That's an interesting question. But they're small, and that's the reason why we don't think of them as much as we should, but they're really, really cool. Yes, so Jim is asking, how would you manage a black cherry like that? If I were going to manage a black cherry, I would take that central leader. So you've got a good, strong tree, and it's doing everything you want a good timber tree to do, which is, and a good yard tree for that matter. It's got a good trunk that's running right up through the middle. It's higher, taller than Jim is now. It's up about, it looks like just the main trunk, not including the new growth that occurred at the top, is probably at least 8 feet tall. I'm going to say it's 8 feet. And I would take that, I would clip that back, and I think you can do it. It's going to be a little tricky at this stage, but I think you can still do it. I would take it back, maybe 3 feet. And then you're going to take it back to what is going to be a new leader, but we won't have quite as much height. Maybe take it back 3 or 4 feet. Those side limbs are going to grow out. You're going to have to trim them as well as time goes on. You're going to have to treat it just like you would treat an apple tree or a peach tree, but not quite as vigorously pruned as a peach tree. Let's call it a modified central leader, like you would do with an apple tree. A peach tree, oftentimes people will... You know, you're looking for something that really doesn't have any center at all. It's almost like a pair of antlers that are opposed to each other, the way those branches come out. Put your hands together at the palms, pull your hands back, stretch your fingers out, and you see how that's kind of like two antlers, big antlers that come together, two moose antlers or something. That's what you're looking for with a peach tree. With an apple tree, you're looking for something a little less aggressive in general, at least the old-fashioned way of pruning apple trees. But that black cherry will get really big on you, and I think it's worth modifying it. Modified central leader. So you're gonna take the top out, it will form a new central leader. You're going to take it out right above another branch. It's growing straight up. Next year, you'll cut that branch too. You'll keep doing that just to keep the tree low and to keep those branches going out. And because a black cherry is going to grow on you pretty fast, you're going to have to do a lot of it. Don't encourage it too much. Don't encourage it too much. But the good thing is, and ultimately what you'll have to do is you'll have to figure out, gosh, do I like this black cherry better than I like that blueberry over there behind it? Because it's going to get big. And but you might really like the fruits. There you go. So we're talking about tomatoes, and I got a lot of information, and it really is interesting. We have, it's kind of bizarre. Plants definitely can take up bacteria if you create unsanitary conditions where you're getting, you can get salmonella in the fruits of plants. And how are we going to deal with that? How do we deal with that? It's something we need to think about. It has a lot to do with how fresh, if you use fresh manure, if your irrigation water is not relatively clean. All of those things are a problem. And so David is suggesting that plastic is designed to solve those problems. It doesn't solve all those problems because you're still going to have potentially a problem with salmonella. So there are probably better ways of dealing with it. I don't know the regulations, obviously, David, and I don't know what inspections are required. It's too bad about the plastic, because now we're going to have to start worrying about microplastics in our tomatoes and in our soils. And this is a big issue. Those plastics generally deteriorate very quickly. There's no question they're contributing microplastics to soils. Something to think about. Something worth thinking about. That we try to solve one problem, and sometimes we create a bunch more that are worse than the ones we had. All right, what else we got here? We are going to talk about basil today. And we'll maybe hang on that in the next hour, because we're coming up on the season for basil. And like tomatoes, I think you really can't appreciate basil unless you're growing it yourself. And I want to talk about that. We're going to talk about the varieties of basil that can be really good. We're going to talk about how I'm using it. You know, here's the thing about basil. It is the great green of our summer. We're developing some other new greens. We're thinking about new greens for the South. We're working on them. I'm really happy about some of them. They're really neat. They're good. Boy, I made some with beans the other night. They were great. But boy, just that first taste of basil every year, and the second taste and the third taste, it just is addicting. Why is it so good? Why do I like that? And what are you going to do with it? Think of it as a vegetable. Don't think of it as an herb. It is an herb that really should be used as a basil, as a vegetable. And you can use it like lettuce in your bacon, basil, and tomato sandwich, if you like. Or just basil and tomato. When just I the full leaves. Got some other thoughts about basil when we come back. Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Steve says it's too hot to listen to the radio. Does that explain why we don't have any callers? I'll let you decide. Seems like it's a good time to listen to the radio, right? Well, I like being outside. Like something, I like this heat. I can't explain why. It just seems to be something that benefits me this time of year. Kind of a nice thing. Getting hot, getting sweaty. Yeah, you don't look pretty going outside this time of year. But where is that a problem for me? I never looked pretty in the first place. There you go. We're going to talk a little bit about tomatoes. We're going to talk about, how to grow. So, David Michael suggested that he's an inspector, and he suggested that, in fact, a lot of the plastic culture that we're seeing has to do with a fear of bacterial contamination of tomatoes and other things from soil. And bacteria, what's really cool, this is the hard part. Listen, bacteria are part of the flavor profile. One of the reasons we love the flavor of tomatoes is the bacterial profile of those tomatoes. And so if we're looking for a bacteria-free environment for tomatoes, we got a problem. What's interesting is that tomatoes can uptake bacteria through the plant, even salmonella. Survival's probably not good, probably not a big threat to humans. It can also be E. coli is one of those bacteria that is an indicator bacteria, maybe not always, sometimes, but not usually, perhaps even, a bad thing in and of itself, but it can indicate that there's the presence of other bacteria, including strains of E. coli, that could be harmful. So we use that as a way to judge whether we do it. And so all this has to do with the fact that suddenly, I don't know, David, always suggesting that we're going to have to grow all tomatoes under plastic now commercially. If we do, it's probably one of the many reasons why your tomatoes are not going to be better tasting as time goes on. And then you get to worry about things like microplastics in your brain, which is probably it probably explains all of us in the end. And maybe the fact that we've got so much microplastics, we can't tell that the rest of us are infected with microplastics, and maybe we're all happier as a result. But all of those things can happen. I just got to say, it's crazy to think that irrigation water from overhead is clearly a source of contamination. Absolutely. Irrigation from drip irrigation? If you're going to have overhead irrigation, I don't know. It's kind of weird. Drip irrigation under the ground, as long as it's not sprayed on the plants, which it shouldn't be if you're growing tomatoes, because you don't want to encourage diseases, shouldn't be a problem. And in fact, there are several studies that suggest that. All right, let's see what else we got. Clay in Birmingham's getting me this. So he's got organza bag. Clay's the guy who always has to remind me what you call these things. They're the little wedding bags. They give wedding gifts in them, and they put rice in them, and they're kind of a, and they make them pretty now with these little pretty white little fabric, what do you call that? You know, ribbon kind of thing that closes it up. But they're really good on tomatoes and other things. So Clay is using it now on cucumbers. Is that right? Cucumbers this year is a way of preventing worm attacks on ripening fruit, and it's working great. So he's got beautiful cucumbers as a result. Those little organza bags are useful, and he used them on his tomatoes to prevent problems on the tomatoes as well. And that's good. You know, one thing I will say is that, and I was going to talk about this with tomatoes and my sort of tomato review. Bee Dark is still having great success with her tomatoes, and I hope she does for a while. But it's the winding down season in Mobile, even if it's the really the winding up season in Huntsville, two different parts of the state. But one of a lot of observations on tomatoes, one of the things, and I keep coming back to this, that there's a lot of information about growing tomatoes out there. I've got to say that the way you want to grow tomatoes in the South is not, particularly in the deep South, particularly in places like Alabama, is to get over the idea that big tomatoes are good tomatoes. In fact, they're not. They are always going to have less flavor, almost inevitably, than smaller tomatoes. It's just true. And, you know, I don't know what the purpose of those big tomatoes are, but they're just not going to have the kind of deep, rich flavor that smaller tomatoes have. And it just seems almost inevitable. I have really not found an exception to that. So smaller tomatoes are great. You don't want to have, if you have a tomato plant, you don't want to encourage one or two big tomatoes, which you could do by thinning out the small tomatoes. But you don't want to do that in the South, because one, you're going to lose those to pests. And so it's always a good idea to have as many tomatoes on a plant as possible, so that you will, because you're always going to have pest problems, unless you tie each one like clay in an organza bag. And if you're going to grow a big tomato plant, you better do that way, because you're going to have stink bugs and other things that are going to get to that tomato, and it's going to make a mess of it. But one way to get around it is just to grow a lot of tomatoes on each plant, so that you have some left over that are not subject to insect attacks or bird attacks or whatever. And there are tomato varieties that even in Alabama will produce so many tomatoes you will never eat them all. You can afford to share. One of those that I've grown is Santiago, and some of you may be trying that one, and it's pretty good, but there are others, and I don't want to emphasize that. I want you to think about it and grow your own and find out which ones work best, with the idea that you still want to grow as many tomatoes on each plant as possible. Now, what that also says is that if anybody's telling you you need to remove suckers from your tomato plant, yeah, you probably don't. One, it's going to be very hard to do, particularly when you get as much rain as we do. And tomatoes are going to grow like crazy. It's really hard to keep up with. But you're not, if they will tell you, oh, well, you'll get more tomatoes. You won't get more tomatoes. You will get less tomatoes if you remove those suckers. That's just inevitable. You're going to get fewer tomatoes if you remove the suckers. There's some other problems. We're going to come back and talk about that.
The fair is blue.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Keith, I can't help but laugh. Not at your citrus. It's getting there, isn't it? I'm not real hopeful about it, but I can't see because there's this guy with a tinfoil hat in front of it. I can't tell. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I can't tell. Sometimes those citrus will emerge later. It is getting late. If your citrus hasn't emerged by the 1st of July, it's getting late. The hopes are dwindling. There is a small fraction of a chance that it will emerge later in July. But at this time of year, you're probably seeing what you're going to see. It's probably going to have a really hard time. Okay, let's see. We were talking about, we were back talking about tomatoes. Listen, the reason you don't want to remove the suckers off your tomato plants is because it does reduce the number of tomatoes you're going to get. It's just that simple. You might get a fewer big tomatoes. The trouble is, of course, that that's not the way you want to grow tomatoes in the South, because you're going to have to dodge lots of pests. And there's nothing particularly good about a big tomato. And once you slice it, you don't know whether it's big or not. There's probably something else about sort of meat to interior ratio that says is one of the reasons why sort of the flesh to interior ratio that is one of the reasons why those smaller tomatoes just taste better. Even if it's a generally large tomato, the smaller version of that tomato may actually, the smaller fruits may actually taste better simply because they have more of that. There's less watery interior and more cell walls and other things that actually tend to pack more flavor. At any rate, don't do that sucker pruning thing. It does mean that one of the things, if you're home growing your tomatoes, put them in cages so that they have room to spread, and they need to be big cages. I am continually experimenting with how to get a tomato cage big enough for some of the tomato varieties I grow. The tomato varieties that keep producing are going to get very, very large in the South. And I mean not 4 feet tall, not 5 feet tall. I'm talking about they're going to be somewhere between 8 and 16 feet. I mean, they'll just keep growing. And so how are you going to manage that? And that requires a little bit of creativity, and I'm not sure I've been creative enough, though I did have a really sprawling, massive frame for my tomatoes, which wasn't really hard to build. And indeed, they kept growing through the middle of summer, and it freaked out the city of Mobile, and they sent an inspector over to make me get rid of my tomatoes until finally we went back and forth for months, and finally everybody agreed, I guess they are tomatoes, and I guess that's not illegal, is it? Bizarre. What an episode. Any rate, yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that. Perry in Fairhope is asking me, have I ever seen, like, thousands and thousands of dragonflies? You know, Mobile is a city of dragonflies. We want to be a city of European planes or whatever. But it's a city of dragonflies. It has been for thousands of years. And sometimes you just get these massive swarms. But I've seen them throughout Alabama. I've seen them along the Paint Rock River, just thousands of them at once. Absolutely an amazing thing when that happens. Swarms of them. What are they doing? I don't know. I've got, you know, one of my best friends is an odonate expert, and I should ask him what they're doing. I'll do that. We'll figure it out. Odonate, dragonflies, damselflies, those kinds of things, darning needles, whatever you want to call them. We'll figure that one out. But they are cool when it happens. City of Dragonflies, Mobile is. Amazing, amazing place when that happens. Somebody's asking me if they have little snails on some of my plants. And there's a lot of them. I pick them off when I see them. Is there something I can spray or pull out to put out to kill them? Huh. So it's very interesting that with young plants, very young plants, I'm talking about seedlings, I think I have a problem with snails sometimes. I'm not sure. Could be other things. Could even be roly-polies. But I rarely have a problem with those small snails on most mature plants. Are you actually seeing a lot of damage? A lot of snails eat things other than plants. Slugs tend to eat plants, and if you've got a lot of them, it's a problem. But I just generally don't see a huge problem with the small snails. So let me know, in case I'm wrong, because I'm not omniscient by any means. And so maybe there's an experience that somebody's having that's different than mine, or different than what I've heard of, in which the little small snails actually become a huge problem for plants in the garden itself. Help me out here if you've seen that and you can verify it. Show me some pictures of what these little snails are eating. Have you got holes? Because those little snails may be eating a lot of other things. And again, on mature plants, I just don't see an issue in general. In general, particularly this time of year as leaves begin to toughen up. What would you do if you did have a problem? Well, in general, I see the problem as where I think, and I'm not certain, I have a problem with snails. I simply move them away from the areas where the snails congregate if I've got small plants and they're in containers, and I move them away. That's a good thing. If you've got small plants in the garden and they're being eaten, you could put collars around them, which could protect them not only from the snails, but from things that are more likely to eat those plants, like, let's say, the stem girdling worms, or cut worms, as we call them. You can put a little collar around those individual plants, but Let me hear a little bit more about the circumstances, whether you're seeing damage, whether that damage is related to the snails. Just a little bit more. I will also say that I never had a problem in my Mobile yard with snails and slugs, and I think one of the reasons I didn't ever was that I had so many frogs and toads. And perhaps playing a smaller role, even though their metabolism is a little lower, is the little Midland brown snakes that we had that were like 12 and 18 inches long and that were really fun to put in your pocket and take around and show people, which was cruel to the snakes, but was a good conversation starter. Snakes are always good conversation starters, of course, particularly when you've got one in your hand. And they're really cool, and I think they were taking care of the slugs and snails. And so how do you get that? Mulch piles help. Gives the toads and frogs a place to hide. Having a little water source in your yard can also help a lot, obviously, particularly if you can get the toads to breed there. And what makes a good breeding pond for toads? We should talk more about that. Can we talk about that? We'll talk about that when we come back.
Well, I can't hunt and I can't fish, but I can drive you crazy, yes I can. Well, I can't even make a dish, but I can drive you crazy, yes I can.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah, I don't know why the weather radio is going off, Keith. That's on. So we're back. So lots of things to talk about. We've been talking a lot about tomatoes. I'm happy to talk more about tomatoes. I'm happy to talk more about basil, and we're going to get back to that. But, you know, we get other questions. The frogs and toads thing really is, it does seem to be very good at controlling things like slugs. And how do you encourage a lot of frogs and toads in your yard? Having the right kind of pond is really important, and I want to talk about this briefly, and we'll spend another day talking about it, and I'll find more research to prove that frogs and toads are actually good, if indeed there is research out there, and I'm pretty sure there is. But when you're trying to encourage frogs and toads to breed in your yard, which is what you want, you love that sound. That sound is really cool. And there are all sorts of sounds. You'll learn to identify the toads by the sound. You know, they could sound like sheep. They could sound like some kind of operatic trill. They can sound like little drums. There are many different sounds. But when you have a pool, you probably don't want fish in it, if you can help it. And you want to have a way for the frogs to climb out. They can get in pretty easy to most anything. It's getting out that's the problem. So be thinking about that. Think about having ramps for the frogs to get out. Or don't have your sides too steep when you're building these pools. And they don't have to be super big either. They seem to actually appreciate sometimes smaller pools. Really cool stuff when you're trying to get frogs and toads. And I think they're really beneficial. Some of us have so many of them, we just barely even notice, think about what it's like when you don't have them. But I've been without. And I can tell you, you can end up with a lot of slugs. And I've actually transplanted toads to areas, and it made a big difference. I don't have a double-blind study, as John Olive would say. But it seems to make a difference when you have frogs and toads. Good thing to do. Somebody's asking me about compost, and it's a great time to talk about compost, and let's talk about what compost is. Compost is, I think compost has misled us. And I think that the reason we're misled is because we read about compost in other places where compost is hard to produce, but compost isn't really compost. What compost really is organic matter. And you really need organic matter. If we can just focus on organic matter, and organic matter is not exactly the same thing as compost. It's a bigger thing than compost, but any quality that you wanted from so-called compost, you can get from organic matter. So what is a good source for organic matter? Leaf bags. Just get all the leaf bags you can. Get it from people who don't throw other mess in with their leaves. That helps a lot. But leaf bags are great. And here's the other thing about compost. I think that people have the idea that with compost, you want something that's fully broken down that looks like soil. If you do that in the South, because things break down so quickly, and you put that finished compost on your garden, it's going to disappear like that. And it's not going to disappear necessarily even into the soil in any way that you can detect. A lot of it is just going to get pooted away. Sorry, I have to use those kinds of words because that's what happens. It's just, oh, I shouldn't do that. But it's what happens. It just, because creatures are breaking it down even further and it turns into organic, it turns into carbon dioxide. And maybe methane and other things that get released into the air, and so you lose that. So what you really want, what makes soil work is the process. Listen, it's the process of organic matter breaking down. It's not some final compost product that you buy somewhere. And if you're buying your compost, you miss the point. Because it's going to be finished. What you really want is just the raw organic matter. And things break down here so quickly, that's where you want to start. And it takes months for a pile of leaves to break down. And I'm talking about during summer, we're talking about 2 to 3 months before it's actually useful for soil. And if we're talking about winter, it might take a little longer, but not much. And so you take those leaves and you lay them down in fall, and they're ready for planting tomatoes in spring. You get your live oak leaves as they drop in March and April, and they're ready for planting your cabbages in fall without even doing much to them. You really don't need to do much. Oh, you can throw some kitchen stuff in there. It might make a little bit of difference. You could throw some fireplace ashes in there if you wanted to. It might make a little difference. You could add a little nitrogen. It might make a little difference, but it's just those leaves breaking down that makes all the difference. So if I told you there was a place to go and buy cubic yards of compost, I would be deceiving you into believing that that's a good thing. I don't know whether anybody does or not. You know, they used to sell this various Milorganite products from municipal waste, and you know what happened? We got plastic in our brains. That's what happened. We've got all kind of problems with that municipal waste, not even the ones we anticipated, but the ones we should have anticipated. And we got PFAS. We got all kind of issues because of using that, but thinking we can shortcut this process. It's the organic matter you need. It's not the finished product of whatever it is anybody's selling. So don't buy into that. It's the process of organic matter breaking down that's beneficial to your soil. And I could go into all the detail why, and we'll do a show in which I go into all the detail why, but I just got to repeat this. Nope, barking up the wrong tree. All right, let's see what else we got. I did say I was going to talk about, we got the frogs. We're going to talk about basil. Have we got time to talk more about basil? Listen, basil is so good. It is such a great vegetable. Treat it like a vegetable. Put it on things. Somebody asked me the other day what kind of lettuce I was growing, and they said, "Ooh, gosh, what is that look on your face?" they asked me. And I guess every time somebody says lettuce, I think, oh, gosh. Because lettuce, I don't care whether it's a fancy lettuce or a non-fancy lettuce, it's pretty insipid. I sort of understand lettuce, but I really don't have a lot of appreciation for it, I got to say. If I'm going to put something on a sandwich, it's going to be kale. It's going to be... cabbage. It's going to be mustard leaves. It's going to be basil. And there's some other things we could talk about. But we're here to talk about basil, and what a cool, nice thing it is on sandwiches this time of year. It's really great, really delicious. It makes great pesto. It's really delicious on pesto. It's really great fresh on pizzas. It's probably good in casseroles and other things that I haven't even thought about. You don't want to cook it too much. You got to think about how to do that, how to cook your basil so that you don't cook it too much. Because it's so good fresh, but just chopped up a little bit. Really good. You can ask me about my pesto if somebody wants to hear, and I'll talk about it all day long about how to make it. It's really great. I use the stems and everything. Cut it, take the tops out, separate the leaves from the stems, chop up those stems, mix them with a little bit of pecans in a skillet, roast the pecans with a little bit of pepper. Peppers meaning chilies. Chiles meaning ajis from South America. Chop them up and put the garlic in the last thing so you don't lose all the garlic flavor and the smell of that. And I actually don't even put oil in there until late in the process. You want to roast your pecans a little bit before you put oil on them. Then you mix that with the basil leaves with a little lemon on them. Oh boy, is that good. And there are various other ways of doing it, and swirl it around in your food processor, but you can also just chop it up. It's really great to do that. So you got the stems, you got all that, it's all in there really good. Chop it up really nice. Makes a great, delicious thing. Mix it with a little starchy water. If you're making a pasta dish, you'll probably put some oil in there. Mix it with a little starchy water as well, which helps a little bit to sort of thin it out, spread those flavors around, but it's better than just using water. So you're dipping that starchy water from your pasta, if you're cooking pasta. And then you can add a little cheese to the starchy water too, which will help to break the cheese up and spread it through the pesto. Is all this making sense? Did you write all this down? I love it. So we did it last night. We got squash. You know, you could just put it on the squash and it would be just great. It was delicious with really good squash. And of course, the squash was some of this Korean squash, like Beet Arc is going to grow, which we don't know how to pronounce, King Kai, whatever it is. And it was delicious, but it was also some other types of squash, which I managed to keep alive. Absolutely delicious. Roast that squash first. So many great things you can do with it. So many great things you can do with basil. Yeah. I love lizards, frogs. They eat bugs, and my dogs love to chase them, says B. Dark. Yes. It's really great to have those lizards, all the great lizards we have. Really fun thing. All the great frogs and toads. Nice thing to have in your yard, along with the dragonflies. We're going to be back after this message. We're going to be talking a little more. We got a little bit of time left. Be sure to give us a call this morning. We'll talk about your garden issues, how to fix them up. It seems a little thin this morning, maybe because it's too hot to listen to the radio. That's what Steve says. It's not too hot to listen to the radio. Not too hot to even go outside. Go outside and listen to the radio.
I was going to say, you can listen to radio anywhere.
Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at any rate, we'll hear. We'll hear more when we get back. Give us a call.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. I am thinking, David got me thinking about why we use plastic growing tomatoes. And it's odd. I'm thinking about bacteria in tomatoes, which is how we started the show. Kind of an interesting subject. We started the show by talking about tomatoes and tomato flavor and how it is a combination of many factors, including bacteria that the profile of flavors may be the result, in fact, does seem to be, according to some research, the result of the interaction of the tomato variety, the genetics of that tomato. I will also add the size of that tomato makes a huge difference in flavor. Smaller tomatoes actually often have more flavor. We can get into that. The environmental conditions in which it's grown, the soil in which it's grown or not. One of the things that research shows us is that tomatoes grown in soil are sweeter than tomatoes grown hydroponically. And as David Hubble points out, growing things hydroponically got to be really complicated at Epcot because they couldn't have bees, and they had to have bees moving things around. And so for pollination, and I don't know how much you need bees for tomatoes, but you do need it for a lot of other crops. Well, you could artificially buzz your tomatoes, tweet them, and sort of twit them, I guess is the better word. But at any rate, all these crazy things you have to do to make them grow hydroponically, and they actually don't end up being better flavor. But the other factor is things in the soil, and the fact that things are growing in the soil actually contributes to the environmental conditions that give flavor. But actually the very soil creatures can give flavor to the tomato as they circulate throughout the tomato. Isn't that incredible? Isn't that weird? Does that bother you? Does that scare you? But that's where flavor comes from, is from this interaction of life. And a tomato is more, the flavor of a tomato is more than just the tomato itself. It's the sunlight. It's the air temperatures. It's the soil creatures themselves, some of which actually may circulate in the very blood of the tomato, right there through the tomato. Isn't that something? So if we try to create these super hygienic conditions in which there are no bacteria, we're probably going to lose flavor as well. Interesting problem. But it's going to be harder and harder for us to find really good tomatoes. You're going to have to grow them yourself. I keep thinking about how could I develop a commercial operation that could grow tomatoes in a great way. We don't pay enough for tomatoes for people to grow them is one of the problems. We don't pay enough for people to pick them. And so it's gotten to be really hard. And plus, we don't have good ways of shipping around. But I keep thinking about that. But I will tell you, if you want good tomatoes, you're going to have to grow them yourself. We're going to have to think about how to do that. We're going to have to do a better job of doing it. We're going to have to plant earlier in spring. We're going to have to plant now. Now is a great time to get your fall tomatoes started. We can talk about them all you want in fall, but it'll be too late to plant them now. Then you want to get those fall tomatoes on the Gulf Coast planted now. It's not too late. Not too late at all, even in Huntsville, but you got to get on it. You got to get on it quick. Start your tomato seeds now so that they'll produce. Don't grow with a variety that takes a super long time to produce. You want to go with an indeterminate variety. That's probably what you want to do for a lot of reasons. But start them now. Start them now. You can start from cuttings. You can start from seed. That's a great thing to do. And then don't put all of your eggs in one basket. You certainly want to think about basil. And it's not too late to plant okra. And not too late to plant peas. It's not a bad time to plant things, begin thinking about things like coleus. and starting to think about things like marigolds, which we'll probably put in sometime in late July. You can order your marigold seeds now so that they'll be ready for blooming in fall. It's a great time for marigolds to bloom. They do it very well then. And you can plant them. It's better to plant them in summer here so that they'll get that fall period of bloom. A lot of really nice things to start thinking about this time of year for your garden. B-Dark said she was going to call, but didn't. She didn't want to take up my time. There it is. Well, of course, B-Dark, I love it when you take up my time. That's what the show's about. Everybody gets to take up my time for 2 hours every Sunday morning. Anybody who wants to take advantage of it. Keith has determined that I did not say a pasta dish, but a possum dish. And maybe I did that unconsciously, Keith, knowing how much you love possum dishes. But we were talking about pasta dishes and basil, not possum dishes. I meant to talk about pasta dishes. And choosing the right pasta for your basil makes a ton of difference. You want something that collects that basil ooziness and gooiness. You don't want just straight pasta. It's not quite as good. You want something with a little curlicues in it, something that'll trap all that stuff. Really great way of doing it. Basil, great thing that's happening right now. It's been a great season for basil. It will continue to be a great season for basil. The one last thing I will say about basil as you're preparing for it is look for varieties that don't go to seed too soon, which they will do in August. And when they go to seed, they lose some of their flavor. And so that's why I use the Rutgers varieties like Obsession, that were actually bred not only to resist certain types of diseases, but the breeding process accidentally, or maybe on purpose, introduced a delayed season of bloom for those plants. And so they keep producing a long time before they actually produce seed, which is really nice. So one of the nice things to look for in basil, and that way you can keep producing vegetables all summer long. And I'm beginning to do that now with the varieties I have. Some of the varieties from Israel that are introduced from other places and have done okay, but I still like the Rutgers varieties Obsession. And I'm going to try to start saving the seeds on those. We'll see how it goes. Some of them came up this year. And they look to be nice and resistant to disease and slow to actually produce seed, which is really nice. Well, we got a summer ahead of us. It's now golf summer. Hot nights. Say goodbye to tomatoes. Say hello to basil if you're on the coast. Say hello to tomatoes and basil if you're in Huntsville.
Just keep on flowing.